80, and one new 185, and involved all of these airplanes, and with the exception of the 185 that blew away in the wind on Mount Hayes. Did we get a Mount Hayes story?
No.
Well, why don't I do it?
Well, you can't either that or...
Why don't you do it? Do it on. Do it when you get back though,
okay.
On your own tape.
Cause wait, then, I write this down.
Write it down. Yeah, yeah. We didn't get anything like that.
Well, here.
There's another thing, Don. Any time that you run into a situation where you ding up an airplane, anything that comes back to your mind, you know, any landing where you had problems or engine trouble or whatever, you know, it may never even use it, you know, but it's nice to stick it in.
Oh yeah.
See, you know, just to break the story up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay, but give me that Mount Hayes story, definitely. Okay.
Go ahead.
Let's see. Okay, the Cub you've got now, I think you said you've owned for 16 years or something?
No, 10 years.
10 years.
63 months.
And how many engines are there?
Well, it's 2,500 hours, and don't have a mark on it. And I've always flown it on small wheel or retractable.
This is the original engine, isn't it?
Yeah, but I have two majors.
Two majors, so you got about 5,000 miles.
No. That's total 20. Time, airplane and engine.
Oh, I
just 2,500 hours.
2,500.
I majored it, I had air power, majored at 500 and at 1,500.
You don't obviously let them run anywhere near to where
they're... No. Well, this last run was 1,000 hours.
Because they're rated at 2,000 or something.
Well, this is, I run it 1,000 hours.
Yeah.
Since the last major.
Yeah.
But, see if you fly these things at sea level, I know. It's critical.
Yeah,
but
right.
When the thing won't climb over
right.
McKinley with the passenger, yeah. Then you have to change engines. Yeah.
I got to put that in. That's great. Okay. Oh, what about that woman at Cantwell? Remember you were telling me about a woman that you picked up and she got squirrely and started pulling.
Yeah,
how did that happen?
Well, one of those calls like you get all the time to run somebody to the hospital.
She was going to the hospital?
Well, that's what they said.
In Anchorage.
So I went up there to pick her up and she looked a little bit wild. So I just sat in the front seat and took off, and that was a mistake.
Yeah.
Because she went 8 in the middle of the takeoff, and we went over the Summit Bank out there.
Ooh.
And we were throwing rocks and dirt 40 feet in the air, and I finally got stopped between a couple of posts without wrecking anything, luckily. And I looked at her, and she was just wild.
Ooh.
And gurgling and clawing and throwing her fit. I shut everything down, drug her out. And they chased us with a couple of trucks and said, what happened? Well, they said, I don't care. So this guy and his wife said, we'll help you. So then we made a mistake. This was a Pacer, a Piper Pacer, which has a door.
Tricycle gear?
No, there it is. Conventional gear Pacer. And, so I set the guy's wife in front and put the husband in the back, right behind the wife, and that was a mistake. We should have put the nutty gal between
in the back,
the wall, and put him by the door, because everything went fine. She was docile and well behaved until we got about 6,000 feet high. And there was a good tailwind, 6,000 feet. So we were roaring along there, and she just went ape again. And she all but got out of the airplane.
Oh.
Just one leg was all this guy had to hang on to.
Holy man.
And tremendous pressure against the door. You can get out, but you can't get back
right,
in because
right.
It traps you like a bear traps you. So I slowed the plane down, got the flaps out, and cut the gal all up trying to get her back in. We finally got her back in, and then I landed in Talkeetna, and there's blood all over the place. Cut her legs tremendously in that door. She's dead. bleeding all over. And wild burning. All the way. Just wild. And then I called Tom Peaton and told him to set a hand on him.
Huh.
And there was a commissioner there, Linda Musgrove. She brought up her head.
Woman commissioner?
Yeah. I had her, this gal, and took her on in and had the cops meet us.
Huh.
FBI.
Yeah. Wow. That'd be enough to make you want to take dual controls out of your airplane.
Ah.
Do you leave the duals in, or have duals
I'll
in?
I'll tell you why.
Purpose?
Because I get to run in these days and nights through one another, and after two or three days and a night or two, you can fire right when you're awake, but it's a big job when you're asleep. So.
Yeah.
And I pick out somebody that looks like they're awake, and let them do some of the flying while you catch a little snooze.
Yeah.
I used to do that quite often with construction crews coming in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Five road jobs down there one time between your anchorage. I had radios and all the cameras.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, until Fairbanks Air Service caught on, it was a pretty deal.
Oh, yeah.
And they run a daily schedule and they screwed everybody up and went broke themselves.
Huh.
On a flat rate fare, but the thing was, I take Roberta with me. She can fly.
Oh yeah,
she does a real nice.
Did she ever get a private ticket, or did she? I know she sold.
No, she said she got 20 or 25 hours to a JG, but man, she should have a problem. But anyway, we was heading back about 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. Heading back into Talkeetna. We delivered 4 of these. Construction type in Fairbanks. And she said, wake up, I'm lost, we're in the fog. And
this is Roberta?
Yeah.
Oh,
geez. So I brought her along to fly the plane back while I slept. Private air, running two or three days in the end, a night or two, and you just get some beach, you can't stay awake. So, anyway, first thing I did, I turned the ABF on, and it pointed at 180 degrees. I said, oh boy, that's something. I must be almost ready to crash into McKinley.
Yeah.
Because if obviously
if
it's pointing at away from
you, right.
Back of you, you're apparently
stations on your
ready
tail.
To hit something in the mountain area, right? That's what I thought. So I cranked it around, called Summit, and at that time it was having a 24-hour watch schedule. And they had a 2,000-foot overcast, and we took her room and down through there. You know, you're supposed to, that mean clears altitude there at Summit's about 6,000 feet. Anyway, we got back down under, and it would wake me up. I didn't have
trouble. Yeah, you didn't have trouble staying awake after that. Hey, I'll tell you, why don't we go out and grab a bite to eat? She's ready to go.
Yeah. Okay. Now, where the heck were we? We talked about scattering the energy. Plane you woman of camera. Okay. What about the baby that was born in the airplane?
Well, strange enough, that was from the same area. Always these propositions take place on black, owly nights and high winds and overcast and snow and storm conditions. This was that kind of a night. A call came in to rush to a place called Cantwell and see if we could beat the stork to the hospital. So I immediately left for Cantwell, and sure enough, when I arrived, a whole group of the residents of Cantwell were trying to assist this late labor case into the airplane, and we took off immediately and got about 80 or 90 miles, and we lost the battle of the stork. The child was born in the airplane, and I'm allergic to screaming women anyway, and this was the first child, and It was quite an ordeal, to say the very least.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, I called Summit Radio, and they relayed some information back to me. And the information was to tie the cord, and I said that the air was so turbulent I couldn't hardly hang on to the airplane. So I asked them if it'd be all right if we left the cord untied till we got the anchorage, and if they'd please have an ambulance down there
right.
So they could do all the honors if and when we got to anchorage.
Yeah.
And we finally got the anchorage all right, and we was met by plenty of personnel that knew how to tie fancy bowline knots and cords, and all went well for 3 weeks, 2 weeks rather. And the mother and child were doing fine, and they returned by a train to Kentwell. And 1 week later, the small youngster caught the fatal case of pneumonia. After he went back to the village of Kentwell. But anyway,
nothing to do with being born on the airplane.
No, but he survived the airplane ride, but he didn't survive the rigors of the Cantwell climate.
Okay. Now, how about your knee, Don? How did you ding up your knee?
Well,
I heard somebody said your
leg destroyed both knees. I'm packing mountain sheep off Wrangell Mountains and up in the Iron Mountains.
Just a progressive thing, or did you do it?
Yeah, well, you see, football, it's commonly known as a set of football knees. Now, you can get them playing football or carrying heavy packs. I got both of my packing. And when you're young and full vinegar, you think you can carry anything. And you're only allowed one issue of the material that separates the major joints of your knee. And when this cartilage wears out, there is no more, and it's non-replenishing.
Right.
And I went to Dr. Mills, the great specialist in bones, and I said, x-ray these knees, they're wiping me out. And he said, fine. So he looked at the x-rays, and he said, shook his head, and he says, you've got enough cartilage floating around in the left knee to start a glute back to you. By the way, what did you do to the right one? Well, I said the same thing, only I probably stepped harder on the left one. Well, anyway, he says, well, what are your plans? Are you going to become a cripple? Continue to carry these loads? And I told him, I said, would it be okay if I just tripled the price of the sheep hunt?
Yeah.
And he says, that's all I can do for you. You get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
What day and what year were you born?
Your birthday. 11/21/21. Jubilee.
Okay. Now, what's the history? When I was listening to Brad Washburn's tapes, he told me that he thought, as a result of you and he flying up to his survey site on the bench at the head of the Ruth Glacier, where your mountain house now stands, that as a result of your activities there with him, that you got the idea for the mountain house.
Well,
he at the time said that he made the statement, what a wonderful place to bring tourists for a picnic.
Yeah.
And he said he wasn't sure, though, and that I should ask you about it.
Well, I looked over all quadrants of the whole range for a perennial landing place throughout the summer. You'll notice that that's on a north, sheltered away from a sun that strikes it in the south. It's in the shelter of the high granite spires to the south. And therefore, the powder snow lasts practically all day on a fresh snow, even in the hottest day of the summer, at the 6 to the 10,000 foot level. And
He said it was good year-round, the lambing.
Right. The main thing is that it's best and most spectacular view of McKinley from any quarter. See, I had the opportunity during that time and since then to look over all the possibilities. Actually, there's five potential ski areas on, around, and on the various quadrants of McKinley. This particular location is the best because it's above the freezing level. Freezing level on any day but a hot summer day is usually around 5,000 feet. This is about 6,000 feet. Therefore, you have powder snow. Most of the itinerant tourists would like to go.
Yeah.
Land on a glacier, take a picture, and be on their way. Some of them would like to stay a month. Some of them have stayed a month, unintentionally.
Yeah.
We get up there and get stuck in the weather. But the weather has no duplicates. July 1 year ago, only one day out of the 31 was McKinley not a flyable operation for high altitude sightseeing and reconnaissance. But usually, it's about a 60% deal where you can have 60% negotiable mountain weather, either due to cloud cover or standing wave activity and turbulence, and 40% when you shouldn't be in there or near it.
Okay. Now, next question. You think it'll be possible to arrange for me to hire your airplane
to go to the mountain house?
Take my wife up there.
Why not?
And spend the night on our anniversary.
Well, why not? When's the anniversary?
22nd of December.
Not this year.
This year.
See, I've got a brand new engine, no problem.
Yeah.
Listen, we can throw that in on the deal. Furthermore, how about, look.
All we want to do, you know, like is drive us out, leave early out in the morning so that we get there at the time you think we should get there to fly up there.
Yeah.
Fly up, take our heavy down sleeping bag with us, you know, mm-hmm. something good to eat for dinner, and just spend the evening there, you know.
You know what I used to do would be to check Tyro's weather scan, and for 10 years, that was, I can still get the information from the RCC, and they know the trends, the pressure trends, the cloud covers, the winds, and the whole ball of wax, and mountain wave activity. See, if clear weather prevails, over about 3 days you get mountain wave, and clear turbulence, you don't need that. But if, on the other hand, it snowed for 3 days, that's a consideration.
Yeah, right.
But here's the trick. It works every time. If you can get in there at the break of the storm, likely there will be a moderation of temperature, and probably you won't get caught by another storm
for a couple of days.
For a day or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, I made a study of the weather up there. And
let's see what she looks like. Maybe even for this
there.
Year.
Besides, we'll put in an HF radio.
Yeah.
There,
let's see what. Let's see. Is this too short notice, the 22nd of December?
Oh.
No?
No.
I'll do it. I'd love to go up there.
Yeah, just get you one and get, listen, get the Alpenglow. Boy, say this summer, we...
Alpenglow.
Alpenglow. That's a gold peak. In the,
oh, yeah, yeah. From the
gold peak in the bronze of the sunset. Sunrise.
See that comet?
Well, no.
Have you seen that thing yet?
No, I didn't see
we
it.
We saw it one night. Boy, that's spectacular.
Ooh,
jeez, it's got a... tail on it, and it was coming. We took the 6:15 one evening. We came up, and it was coming right over here across the front.
Yeah,
moving along, and man, was that thing going? It was moving just about this fast on the horizon.
Yeah,
jeez, that thing was going. Great, big, long tail on it.
Got a good look at it.
Yeah, just the one night.
After the first
Well, what would a guy have to take up there for gear then?
Outside gear.
Real warm clothes and warm
windbreaker.
Yeah.
Then you wouldn't need them.
Yeah.
But if you don't take them, you might need them.
Yeah.
Oh, snowshoes.
Yeah. Is there a heat up there?
Oh, yeah. I have dried birch. To burn in the hibachi. You know that nice warm picture in that one magazine? Or one book?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Where it's comfy and it's insulated.
Huh.
And stick a birch and you can heat that thing up to where you have to open the windows.
Yeah.
There you go. 21 years. 20 years. Really?
Yeah.
You're talking about your birthday. You wouldn't believe that.
I was only 9 when I got married.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We'll keep an eye on it then. We'll figure on doing that. We'll just leave you to figure the weather.
And
she looks good while it's blue.
No problem. Short day of the year.
Yeah. Other famous.
Oh no! Wait, it gets six
21st.
Minutes longer.
Yeah.
One minute longer the next day.
Okay. Other famous bush pilots, the biggies. Have you known any of them personally?
Oh, golly, I know most of them.
Like Crossen. Crossen.
Crossen was Pan American executive,
right.
And he went to Seattle in the head office, and he had a heart attack at the age of 44 down there. But Gillum and Crossen and the old 97W. The Flying Cowboy used to fly McGrath, and those guys were all really active about 38.
Right.
38. They were really active.
Radabaugh.
Jimmy. He was a little earlier, and in this area.
And Eielson, of course. He was 27.
Yeah, but 38. They were really rolling. Peterson, North Consolidate, was flying up a storm. And Chris Christensen, he even come up and flew some of our little birds.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And
Haka.
Haka and Chris, he used to fly the war.
Did you know that Roy Holm by any chance?
No.
Did you read that in the paper? Where the guy, he just retired from Pan Am.
$30,000.
Yeah, retired. He was an old bush pilot up here. He worked for Pan Alaska.
I was over there at McGrath.
Pan America
had Pan American Shack on the west side of the the east west runway. It was about 1,500 feet long, and all the golly. Winchell. Oscar Winchell.
Winchell.
Yeah. Oh, used to see Red Airplane.
Okay.
And Schultz, of course, he was a kind of a new timer, but he was flying up a storm. I got a picture of a Waco, you know that one? Did you see the one? No, it's a Blanca over the Mediterranean, 41. Got a good picture.
Did
Schultz's mail plate.
Talking about pictures, one time you mentioned that you got a picture of you.
I don't know, were you carrying Batkeen? Yeah.
Can you see the airplane on the picture?
Well, I carried him out of the airplane down at Merrill Field. Some guy had to take a picture of him.
You see the airplane?
I don't know. I think you might be able to. I'll try to
look. Would be a good one that we might want to include for the dust jacket. Look, that's the type of picture they're going to want.
Listen,
just bang on that.
Yeah. What kind of a name do you think I've come to?
I don't know. That's almost their prerogative.
Yeah, but what do you think?
I don't know. I hope they don't give it. I'll be perfectly honest with you. That wonderful book that Glacier Pilot is. I hope they give it a better title than Glacier Pilot.
That's a good title.
But it's kind of. Nowadays, well, I'll tell you, people are a little more sophisticated. They want something a little more pizzazz to it, you know? Whatever it'll be, I don't know. But see, they know what's going to
go a long ways.
They know.
Get a title as good as that.
Well, yeah, it tells you what the book is. Of course, you can't have anything about glacier piloting anymore because that book.
No.
But they'll come up
with
something. They know what'll sell.
Yes, 63, about May of 63, the Anchorage Times has a picture of that too in there.
Were you carrying it?
Yeah.
One of these times, you know, I'm going to go down to Anchorage and I'm going to go through their morgue down there. They're going to pick the morgue.
It's beat off the Anchorage.
That?
No, that I'm talking about Canelli on the Cassin's crew. Batkin come out feet first.
Yeah.
No, I didn't carry Batkin.
Well, this was
Canelli.
What was this other one?
Well, he was part of the 9-man Cassin crew. I haul all them out.
There's nothing about that on the tape.
Well, Jesus.
I've got a description of the Cassin climb where Cassin froze his hands.
Oh, the feet
went
their
up
faces.
And came back down, but I didn't. There was nothing about.
Oh yeah, see, I met him.
A guy losing his hands, feet.
Oh yeah, Canelli, the great athlete.
Maybe you could, in addition to that Mount Hayes thing, don't forget to put that on tape. Maybe you could stick something about a little more information on the Cassin climb on tape.
Well, see, I've been watching them come down, and they're moving just inches a day. And finally, when the first guy got to 11,000 feet, I snatched him out of the base of the south face. And then the rest of it came down, just moved, dragged slowly down over the seracs and crevasses, and they'd get to some place I could pick them up. I got them, all of them, before they got to 9,800 feet. All of them. But you should have saw what they came down. And their hands were frozen.
Well, there was fixed lines.
Like hams.
Where they left their lines.
Well, they left their fixed lines, but boy, you have to be nimble to pound in fresh lines. They went more than 4,000 feet straight up after they froze their hands.
You never did, I think I asked you one time, you don't know how much the wage was.
No, but Cassin will know.
Yeah.
If he'll tell us, I'm sure he might.
Okay, when did, I already got the answer to that, when did you hear of the Deep Bob Reeves? Major incidents, we all said on that. Don't forget that Mount Hayes. Okay, something that I've got to put in, not put in the book in dollars and cents or anything like that, but I've got to be able to indicate somehow how the ownership of Talkeetna Air Service transferred over into your name.
$50,000 plus 3% interest is how it transferred over.
Right, I know. But I mean, originally, first of all, Morrison held most of it.
Well, Morrison? Wait. You have a tape on the fishing expedition with the two gas boxes full of rainbows. Okay.
He bought the planes then?
No, he would put a down payment on the plane.
Right, and then you'd take it down.
And then I'd get a contract. You see, the Denali Highway was not built at that time in 49. See, in 48 was when I met Morrison. And he decided, he said he wanted to, where did you get those big rainbow trouts? Tremendous monsters, just fit in a gas box. It came right from the mouth of Pocket Bear Lake, to be exact. But anyway, I told him I wouldn't tell him, but I'd show him. And if he could be ready in 20 minutes, he could ride back because the trip in had been paid for. He said, fine. So up spring the laundry truck, and out come Morrison with all kinds of fishing tackle. And a while look in his eye, and he said, let's go. So we went up there, and the fish were still striking. Unconsciously, and he'd never seen anything like it. And he said, the reason I came to Alaska was to go fishing, but the minor reason was to come up and collect $10,000.
Yeah, right, for that laundry deal.
Yeah, you had that. Okay. So he immediately sold the laundry and moved to Talkeetna. And Then he bought the bucket of blood, the scene of the holiday Mexican style. Okay. And then he would say, what kind of a plane will take off on floats quickest? All the biggest load.
Well, now, prior to when he was doing this, though, did he and you...
As I was writing, a lot of other things I thought about that I'm going to need later on, and they're just a general bunch of stuff. Okay, we'll talk about the contract after a while when Kime gets here, so I won't make any... We won't talk about that now. Okay, when I wrote the description of the Loshi rainbow trout incident on the Talkeetna River, okay, whatever happened to the third guy? Now, when you started telling me about it,
wait,
he just disappeared.
You
picked the woman up out on the river, the big nude woman, and got her back to Talkeetna, and then she bought drinks all around. And
the third member of the party arrived after Loshi came into the old CA station.
Yeah. He walked in.
Yeah, he made his way. He had been watching.
And Loshi didn't know where he was. I mean,
well, as I recall, he thought he'd lost a boat.
Yeah, right. That's what you said on the tape.
Now,
so
when he's still around, we could ask him.
He walked out the same day.
Well, see, it was only an accident that I came back at 3 in the morning from this circus.
Yeah, right.
2 or 3 in the morning.
Well, I wrote that thing up in a kind of a semi-humorous way, you know.
Yeah, well, sure it had to be.
But I had to do that all the way through. So what I did, I in a way, didn't make light of the airplane accident, Joe. But I described it, I didn't, you know, get all involved making it sound like a big hairy thing. In other words, he wiped the airplane out,
well,
obviously.
Well, there was a lot of reservation a cautious note when the big gal asked Loshi. She said, honey, she said, I can't get my belt buckled.
Yeah.
And he said, no problem, this is going to be a smooth takeoff.
Oh, jeez. I wish I'd have had that in there.
Well, put it in.
Yeah, I will. I wonder if I should use Loshi's name.
Call him and ask him. Say, are you having
a
signed release?
That's it. So you got to have a signed release for that.
Yeah.
Because,
well,
you know,
they always get me the signed releases on their TV stuff and on Ice Palace and on the Sourdough Story and on High Adventure and Bold Adventure and that whole bunch. The various. They always get you the signed release. It might not be a bad idea.
Yeah, well, I can call him. He's here in town, of course.
Yeah, that'd be a good deal, because that is what went on. That's what the gal told me. She said,
Jesus.
So 7 miles down the river, they was barely up on the step, and they came to this non-negotiable turn.
Yeah.
And he reefed her into the sky and flew 50 feet and landed with a tremendous crash in the middle of this pile of stumps. And then the pieces went crashing and sailing and cartwheeling back into the river.
And this guy must have floated down the river a little ways or something.
Boy, he thought he lost a boat. Now, that's my version.
Yeah.
Now, I think the other guy staggered into the airport all skinned up sometime later. I think.
Yeah.
I don't believe the guy that I saw there was close.
Okay, let me. Jake, you go play now.
Yeah.
Okay, now, next thing. Oh! Here's something that you've never said anything about, and all I have to do is have just a superficial description of it, and that was when you married Roberta. When it was, and I heard somewhere along the grapevine, I think Roberta told me, that you got your skis stuck in the ice on your honeymoon.
Oh, boy.
We got to have that in there, because, that's
well,
great.
Well, here's the thing. See, we hired 3 pilots and 1 mechanic, and I always question stay away from the inlets and the outlets of these lakes.
It's hard to find.
Anyway,
what happened. We pulled up to this cabin, and I thought it was far enough away from the shore, but there was a warm Chinook wind blew that night, and it was the 15th of May, and in spite of the fact that I was far enough away from the shore, the ice lost its tensile strength. So I noticed this deterioration of the ice the next morning, and I very gingerly stepped in the plane, started it up, and packed it about 10 feet, and the thing fell through the ice. But I didn't damage anything.
Yeah.
I just started it up, and it started to sink, so I shut it down, and it landed with the prop crosswise and didn't do any damage.
Oh, yeah. That was the first night of your honeymoon?
Yeah.
What now? What year was it?
May 15th.
64.
64.
Okay. Now, where was it? Where was the cabin?
Was it on some lake? Nice lake, yeah. Swamp lake. But the thing was, two of the guys flying for us, I call them on the radio. Had a gal running on a big radio in the office. All of a sudden, the hands of the chain was, the plane fell through the ice. There they came, and they dropped a box of Wheaties. Said that the ice looked too thin to land on, and I could walk out.
Yeah, keep you going until you got out.
Yeah. Right. So anyway,
hey, there'd be a great title for the chapter right there. If the guy wrote that up and has that as a centerpiece in the chapter,
Champions. Yeah. So anyway, I was wild, and so they went, they disappeared and went away. And they came back in about a half hour and landed with blocks and tackles and everything.
How many guys did you have working for you? These were actually...
Well, wait. At one time, I bought the bulk plant in Calpena. That was the 40,000-gallon Union Oil bulk plant. I had six airplanes flying at once, and I had two riverboats going at once. And I had a Tasty Freeze ice cream stand. One day I made $47.25 trying to mow the front lawn. I got a run on this Tasty ice cream freeze, and Roberta landed in the middle of that rat race. This tremendous Chinese fire drill with everything happening at once. You can't imagine. See, we was trying to run it with a tight force. You'd have one guy running the ice cream stand and river boats. Well, that would put him miles apart from the ice cream stand. Or somebody trying to, I would try to fly all these airplanes and work on them and license them. And then once in a while, I'd get weathered in up on McKinley.
This was all in the mid-60s.
Yeah. And finally, Roberta said, wait a minute. She said, we're hiring all these people, and we're doing all these different things. What part of it do you want to keep? Do you want to junk the airplanes and keep the ice cream stand, or do you want to get rid of the bulk plant, or do you want to buy more river boats, or just what do you want to do?
Yeah.
And I said, listen, you got a point there. Let's just get rid of it all and keep the airplane.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Where'd you meet Roberta?
Oh, I knew her for years.
Yeah, I assumed that you had. When did you meet Bob Reed?
Well,
as a matter of fact,
the summer of 40. Over on in McGrath. He was flying this old Boeing Trimotor over there, hauling freight. And I'd seen the plane.
Summer of 40. That would have been when you were working on the airstrip.
Yeah. Well, we...
Just before you flew out of there.
Farewell in... let's see, 40. Old Farewell started in 40. McGrath started in 41. Ruby, I worked at Ruby.
Ruby before McGrath.
Yeah.
And then from McGrath, you went back to Anchorage and into the airport.
No. I went to work at Eklutna and in 39, worked the fall, this summer, a couple of months, remember? The mine episode. and I were going to go directly out.
Floated the river.
Well, here. The fall of 39, they started the 4,000 foot runway. So after the minor season, just a smidgen would work there.
Right.
Okay. But anyway.
And then that was the winter you went to the university.
No. Wait a minute. We're getting the thing screwed up by 1 year. That was, let's see, it was 40, almost 40, because Kripke, I worked over at Kripke's mine the following year. Wait a minute, we're getting the Yukon deal. Let me get it straight. See, we know it's 39 for Jacobs.
Right.
Right. Now, wait a minute, it was 40 for Mike Kripke's Dutch Creek. So it had
to be in the winter.
Wait a minute. It had to be McGrath in 41. It was. It had to be. It had to be McGrath in 41, and that's where I met, ran into the old Boeing. I'd seen it flying out of Maryland.
Okay, so 39 during the summer.
Yeah.
You worked for Jenkins.
Right.
And in the winter of 39, fall of 39.
Well, in the fall of 39, I went on a big big circuit to visit everybody that I, all of the relatives, stateside.
Right.
Then I said, wait a minute. I blew this summer stake in and had a great time, visited all the relatives and went to California and everywhere. Mm-hmm. But they said, this is a fun way to spend that. Hard-earned summer stakes. So then I said, in the fall of 40, after I finished this Kripke's mine operation, then I'll go. That was the fall of 40 I'm coming up to. Up to Fairbanks here.
Fall of 40.
Yeah, that's the way it was.
Okay, and then fall of 40, and then the next year, the next summer, spring and summer,
and then
you floated the river.
May 4th.
That's when you took off down,
41,
down the river.
May 4th, 41, exactly. I checked the ice pool breakup. That's
okay. And then that you ended up at Ruby and eventually
Ruby
McGrath.
And then to McGrath.
Then you
then
met Bob.
Farewell. Reed. Well, I'd seen him, but I helped unload freight out of his old Trimoyer.
Okay, and then after that was all over, then of course we were in the war.
Well,
winter of
41. No, wait a minute. So Clancy, E.I. Clancy, the engineer, kept getting me 6-month deferments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I've got that in.
Well, yeah, but I didn't want any deferments.
Yeah, right.
I
you wanted to get out.
Want getting the Air Corps. Anyway, but there was no way to get out of McGrath, man, unless you took a dog
team
right. or walk.
Yeah, I've got that all.
Everything's high priority. Anyway, Lars Johnson come
right.
into the picture then.
Right.
He'll fix you up, and he picks me up with a C-47, right?
Flew out, put in a froze to death.
Huh. Yeah, I took
him. Remember that.
Wood sleeping bag. But anyway, so that carries us on to 42 then.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. Then I got that. So you met Bob. Now, when did you meet Roberta? I mean, with
in about 60.
60?
Yeah. Okay.
And probably in Anchorage?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
See, at the dinners, and I have some film on my own. And once in a while, they used to keep me hopping. I tried to phase out.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah, to go down and to the, 18th of the month, I'm supposed to be angry.
She wants stuff like that.
Yeah, there's an Anchorage medical profession. Wanna see some pictures? This is a real. I should have brought up that roll of the dolphin team in Japan because that's a good one.
Would you like to go out Johnny Carson show?
Oh no, I that's a waste of time.
Not if we're selling a book, it isn't.
No,
listen, the reason I ask is this. This is, you know, like at this point of the, this stage of the game, this is truly, truly pie in the sky.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is this. We are going to reach the point after this book comes out where we're going to have to promote it. Okay.
Well, listen,
now, that don't mean we're going to have to promote it personally. But the thing is, I know Hugh Downs.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of Hugh Downs? He used to have the Today Show. He's a television personality type. Okay, anyway, I have a feeling that if this book is reasonably successful, I think that I can, if I put my mind to it, I think that I can get the thing set up so that we can put in 10 or 15 minutes on one of the Tonight Shows. They'll fly us there and fly us back.
Oh, yeah.
And all we got to do is sit there, and if you got a segment of, say, 2 or 3 minutes of movies of mountain flying, and tell them about the book, that's it. That's all he wants.
Might be all right.
We could sell a lot of books.
Gee, yeah.
Just tremendous advertising.
Yeah, but
you know what he gets for a minute of advertising on that thing? Something like $25,000 a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to advertise a pair of socks on that show.
Yeah, yeah. Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
Listen,
and they tape it.
But no, I think if you really wrap her up, it'll do it on her own merit, hopefully.
But they don't. I tell you, even these big books like what's his name is right big book now, just finished writing this book. You'd be surprised. They had the guy that wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull on there. About a month after he wrote it. You bet. Bach was on there. And
It might be on.
Gotta advertise it, you know. Once it catches fire, then you got it made. Then you can sit back and let the thing sell itself.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just thought of that, you know, when you were mentioning these films.
Listen,
okay.
There's, you know, as I said, there was this for a while. It was about 10 years of this old adventure stuff. Boy, there's a lot of good stuff shot up in the mountains.
You've got some good pictures of you landing up there on the glacier and all this good stuff. That's, you know, true.
Well, these were television shows.
Yeah.
And
well, they can get the tapes on those.
Old Adventure, Giant Adventure, and all those fields.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, but this is all television tapes, see?
No, that's
I say, for some of these primeval places, there's opportunities. Like this Dolphin show.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah, right.
That's a knockout.
Oh, sure.
The scenery and everything.
Boy.
Natural setting. It's got ancillary rights you're talking
about. Right.
It's
right.
Got possibilities.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's the next thing here. Okay. There was a discrepancy, not necessarily discrepancy, but when you were describing your work with Washburn.
Yeah.
We would talk about, I knew that you were working with Washburn from 51 through 60.
Well, it was 59, because the map
59.
Came out in 60.
Okay, right, but I mean, that was when the map came out in 60.
Yeah.
Okay, now, when you were talking about your work with Washburn, you'd mentioned that you were continually, I got the impression that you were continually busy with him all that whole period.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that this was correct. That's why I interpreted.
He had to... Adams Carter is scientific brains,
right.
And he was on some of the survey projects. And what they would do would be put a team in an area that they hadn't surveyed.
Right.
And
I mean on the basis of years.
Well,
Washburn's tapes claim. He says that he didn't
throughout the years.
He wasn't even in Alaska between 51 and 53 or 54.
Well, just the segments.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, okay.
But when they get up ahead of steam, then...
55, you worked with them a lot.
Well, yeah, but there was thick and thin.
Yeah. Okay, that's all. I just wanted to make sure that I had interpreted it right.
No, it wouldn't be as...
Maybe he forgot something.
8 hours a day.
Know. Yeah.
24 months a year deal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's see. Okay, the first 2 or 3 chapters we're going to talk about after a while. Oh, one time when we were talking, and I think I've got this on tape someplace, you mentioned this episode. In fact, I'm sure I've got it on tape. You mentioned this episode where you scattered this woman's ashes.
Yeah.
From altitude, and you run into problems with the thing blowing around in the hole in the cabin. What I wanted to ask you was, how often are you requested to do that?
I've got one or two of them stacked up in the back waiting to go now.
In the back of the airplane?
No. In the wolf house in our warehouse back there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I suppose.
What would you say on an average year?
Well, probably. I suppose every 4 or 5 months you
can use a client. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, who are these people mainly?
Well,
they have to be climbers.
Look, you're absolutely right. Grace Vincent Holman, Dr. Grace Vincent Holman, was the leader of the Denali Damsels, the first all-girl team that climbed McKinley. And she was involved in a fatal avalanche accident, as was Hans Wanderlaan, an engineer.
I think I've got this on tape.
Yeah, well, all right, but this is just to give you an example of who wants their ashes scattered.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Anyway, unbeknown to me, she was always really sharp-tongued and a severe gal, really severe. I didn't ever think that she'd want me to scatter her ashes. I'd have thought.
Yeah.
Although I haul her every place she went.
Yeah, right.
But nevertheless,
not the type you'd like to spend the evening
shooting
the breeze with.
Yeah, well, that was one of her requests in her will, that she was scattered on McKinley, only it happened a lot sooner than she figured.
That was, right.
Because they...
Was that the one that blew all over the cabin?
No, that had been years
before. That one will be anonymous, obviously. In fact, I may not even mention it. I'd like to, though.
Well,
because that's...
Here's the thing. Roberta said, how can you stand out in that office, the mountaineers we talk about?
Yeah.
They say, what about Bouillard, the famous pathologist? We heard that you were hopping on the outside.
Yeah.
I explain it, and Roberta is behind the door ready to kill me.
Well, Jesus, you got to get him down off
this
of there.
This is... Sure. Is hypocrisy.
No.
To defile a fine person like Dr. Bouillard, I say, these guys want to know what happened and how I'd ever get a man that
big. That's right. Listen, Bouillard probably be tickled pink that you flew him off the mountain and tied on your airplane.
But the thing is,
how else are you going to get him down? You can't wish him down.
But you can't overlook all his feelings, there is.
Yeah,
if you don't tell the rough and the tough.
Well, do his relatives know how you got him down off the mountain?
I want to tell you that every 15 minutes on the hour, 24 hours a day, we had a phone call or a wire.
So they know.
They didn't care how I got him
right.
out, just so I got him extracted.
There's the answer.
And boy, that.
But you know, down in this book, a guy can't soft foot it too much. In other words, you've got to call a spade a spade,
because
or she ain't going to have the old punch.
That's right. Farm on every takeoff.
Right.
You're not
right.
going to
soft pedal. Right.
The fact that you're going to bust your fanny.
That's right.
On every takeoff.
Exactly.
You've got to get in there and give her
that's
the full try.
Exactly. So I'm going to write it
that
way.
Kind of a deal.
What I'll do it this way. I won't even ask you who the person was that blew all over the cockpit of the plane.
Yeah.
But I'll mention it, and I'll mention it this way. I'll say that you had been increasingly receiving requests to do this. And you decided to accept one, and then
was the first one I'd had.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. The first one that you did.
No.
First one you were accepted.
No.
First request
that
you had.
The first request was the ash job all over the cockpit. I was just getting checked out on how not to do it.
Yeah.
See,
okay.
No, I hadn't had any requests prior to that. As a matter of fact, I called my lawyer. I said, McCutcheon, I got a request here. From a fella, he called up and he said he wanted his wife taken to a high altitude of McKinley.
Older down. No, she's still running.
And I said, well, does she have a climbing permit?
And the voice on the other end of the phone said she don't need a climate permit. She's cremated in a small box, like a cigar box. Well,
yeah.
I said, send her up. So I said to McKinley, this is great. Now, the request was that she be scattered to the four winds.
Yeah.
Now, you have to be pretty high if you're going to get scattered to the four winds.
Just four winds, Lord.
You would go to the four sides of the mountain and scatter a little here and there. But, okay, so I said, McCutcheon, now, tell me, can you think anything that would be a legal obstacle on this type of an operation, since it's the first request and I'm going to carry it out?
Yeah.
And I'll do it on a flight in the area, and I won't have to build up people to fight. Well, he said, fine. He said, read me the serial number on that cigar box. It isn't a cigar box.
Yeah, right.
It's about yay big and about that big. Okay, so he said, well, he said, you know, he put in an apprenticeship as an undertaker. He said, that's
he was an Anchorage attorney, I was.
Yeah. He said, well, look, he said, that's a bona fide number. He said, that came from the West Coast. And he knew it just like that.
So
the number of the crematorium was the West Coast
yeah.
number, and he said, that's a bona fide number. Well, and not a backyard job.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a possibility of it being a backyard
sure.
job.
See, sure.
Well, so the thing that impressed me was that I am here at 14,500 feet roaring around in one hell of a turbulent wind.
Yeah.
And I figured it would be ideal to scatter the ashes.
Yeah.
So I reached over, opened the window, took the lid off the support, and just about half asphyxiated myself with ashes
right
in my hair, all over the cockpit. God. You couldn't see in my eyes, in your nose. And the most disgusting thing was this big chunk of bone in the bottom of the box, big enough for a dog to chew on.
But better not put that in there.
Well, that's telling you.
Yeah, right.
What was, because I'm feeling very in a position where I will do humanity a service by carrying out the last wish,
sure.
And I'm more or less mourning this poor person that went to a crematorium and all and died and everything, and it's got a very big and piecemeal kind of air to it until I come to the dog that the dog bone in the bottom of the box. You see?
Yeah.
You see? that took the flavor out of the whole deal.
Yeah.
When I run into the bone.
So you got that done, but then after that you have these number when we one every 6 months of requests.
Well, yeah.
And you've done this
at odd intervals.
How do you do it now, Doc?
I take the lid off after the package is outside the airplane.
You hold it outside the airplane.
Yeah. Yeah, man. There's no way.
So you're
never going to get the lid off
the
inside of the airplane
out.
And take the package to the outside of the airplane.
What kind of an airplane was it?
That
first one, the 180. The first one that you've done.
Okay. But don't second guess.
Oh, no.
Ask me.
Yeah, right. Well, that's why I got all this stuff on here, see, because I haven't written about that at all yet. I haven't come to that yet. Okay. Now, this is going to be a tough one, I suppose, in a way. But it's hard. What I'd like to do as I go along through this whole thing is sort of keep pace with the type of airplanes you use.
Well, basically, they are all the same.
Right, Cubs and 180s. I mean, now, for instance, on that Devil's Canyon thing, you used a Rocket Sedan.
Yeah, right.
And
that was a cool.
Yeah, right. Now, I assumed that you were using that because it was the only plane you had on floats at the time.
Right.
That was the way I wrote it up.
Right.
Okay. But now, when did you get your first Super Cub?
Well, I owned a fleet of Cubs.
Right, I
know. In 49, the 105 Cub came out, so I bought two of them.
Bought two of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And 49, 50, and then they started to go 108 engine to the 125 and 135.
When did you get your first 125?
Yeah, and the number on it was 1924.
That was the first 125 horsepower.
Yeah, that was 51.
And how about the first 150 horsepower?
Well, in about 53, I got a for 135, and in 55, I bought two 150s. So, they come out 55.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'll put the sheet in the. Found out an interesting operational problem, and that was that it was a big job to land the new 150s where you can land the 105s.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Higher airspeed.
Well, heavier. Heavier.
They did. They beefed the airframe up that
yes,
much.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, this is another thing that I don't have on here. What did that Aranca weigh empty, approximately?
On floats, that should have went about 1,300.
I was going to guess 1,250, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I just left it blank.
Well, that wouldn't be interesting.
Well, the reason I mentioned it in the story was because you were obviously watching weight when you were floating in that
Ooh.
In that river. Ship.
Well, it was an underpowered airplane. Anyway.
Right. So, you know, I bring that stuff in there because it's kind of interesting.
While you can turn around and take off.
Okay. When did you get your first 180?
Well, in 53, the 180s came out, but I was skeptical. So I bought five 170 Cessnas with one standard and four with the old